Thank you, Chair. We've distributed two documents. As you said, the B list, we were asked to prepare a document that's more or less going to be the B list. We've done that. There's still some options that are in there. We've done renumbering as well. So the three new clauses that were have been 3A, 3B, and 3C have got their numbers in the context of the bill. And we've also done the cross-referencing. That might change as a result of deliberations today. And then we've also distributed an adapted memorandum on the objects, clearly showing the changes that are proposed for the committee's consideration. I think that's it. So most of the amendments or the document that it looks like now the provisions as they are now in the new document are provisions that the committee has seen that I think, and I'd like your guidance on how we deal with it. Should we just go straight to the areas which are really new or areas that require further deliberation, or do we go through the document right from the beginning and point out the changes to the introduced bill right from the start?
Honourable members. Debbie, JJ.
I think if we could just have an idea of the new one first and then perhaps go through.
Okay.
Along the same lines, let's
deal with
the new one and then
we are going to
be important.
All right, Mr. Best.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Mr. Roberts to assist that.
Thank you. As from the last meeting, the following amendments were inserted. The first one is on page 6 of the B list. It relates to a defence clause. We've inserted it in the application clause of the bill, but it's an alternative to the defence option that appears in clause 9, which is on page 19 and 20. And on page 15 of the bill, we redrafted.
Chair, we're not going to discuss each issue as we go along. I think that may be better.
I think so too. Yeah.
So Chair, look, the first issue is the media aspect. I mean, if colleagues would remember what I think it was Abusa was wanting was effectively a defence. That if you could show that you were engaged in the conduct for the purposes of detecting or preventing an offence, revealing a threat to the public safety or in the environment, reveal that an undue advantage is being given or was being given to the person in a competitive bidding process or complying with a legal duty. That was a defence, and effectively, you, my reading of it would be that you couldn't get a protection order. You would then escape the protection order. That effectively would mean that journalists would be exempt. And I don't know if even the journalists would argue that journalists would never conduct themselves in such a way that creates unreasonable conduct. So the solution, I thought, and I did raise it with a number of members of the committee beforehand, and then had asked Mr. Bassett if something could be drafted, was instead of making it as a defence, make it an issue, factors that the court should look at in deciding whether the conduct, because remember for harassment you need a requirement is unreasonable conduct, whether the conduct was unreasonable. So it's basically, as they put it, it's under on page 19 under the option, the alternative option to 4A, for the purposes of deciding whether the conduct of a respondent is unreasonable. for the purposes as provided for, referred to, whatever, in paragraph A of the definition of harassment, the court must, in addition to any other factor, take into account or consider whether the conduct in the particular circumstances was engaged in, and then those factors are listed.
Mm-hmm.
So to my mind, that is a good compromise or a good attempt to address the media's concerns. It doesn't exempt them from getting harassment orders, but it means that the court, in deciding whether the conduct was unreasonable, must look at the purpose for which it was being conducted. So, in other words, if you are being accosted in the street by an arbitrary person who is giving you attention for some or other unknown reason, that's different to if you're being accosted in the street by a journalist who's investigating a story. So they had put it, though, as effectively two options. The one is for A, the other then is at the end of the definition section. My worry about it being, and it's the same clause as far as I can see, my worry about it going in the definition section, that's the one on page 6,
mm-hmm.
The first one that Mr. Roberts referred us to, is that it then becomes a factor that needs to be, or that may need to be looked at in the interim order. And the whole issue of the interim order was that it needs to be speedily granted. If the court has to hear the other side, then it would take a lot longer, and it in a sense does away with the urgent and quick procedure for an interim order. Now again, the media's concern, so that's my worry, and we did have quite an extensive debate around should it be a defense in the interim order. Media's concern then is that they can get hit journalists can get hit with interim orders, but there is a provision, Mr. Bassett, you can remind me where it is, that the return date can be anticipated. Is it page 9? Subclause 5 on page 9. The return dates referred to, that's for the interim order, may not be less than 10 days after service has been effected on the respondent, but a return date may be anticipated by the respondent on less than 24 hours notice to the complainant and the court. So I would feel that's a protection for journalists. So if they feel that the protection order is unfair, it's interfering with their work, they had legitimate grounds to be pursuing this person, they can then anticipate the return date and get the hearing heard earlier.
Good. Excellent. Yes, very good. Timmy?
Mr. Chair, I also had similar concerns regarding the time periods, and I think that the 24-hour notice provision does address that. So, I mean, normally I think investigative journalism in any event doesn't take, you know, it's not just happening overnight. It takes some time to get going and to complete. So I think the fact that they can come back to court and anticipate the date on one day's notice effectively, they can bring the case to court much quicker and have the decision made. So I think that probably is a correct balance between the rights of the media as well as the rights of individuals. On the issue of the definition, yeah, I think that's probably fine. I do want to raise another concern about the definition of harassment at some point, whether I should do it now or not, I'm not sure, or later. The unofficial chair says later.
Later. Let's deal with this. Mr. Robertson, you wanted to come in?
Well, as Mr. Jeffrey said, if the definition is included in the Act itself, under Section 1 as a definition, it is true. When a court considers a protection order, even at the interim stage, you will have to take that into account. While it is included in the Act on page 19, clause 8, it will mean that the court can only consider that defences on the return date. So we basically agree with that.
Good. Steve?
Chair, we also in agreement after considering the issue. I think think we can proceed on that basis. I think there's sufficient protection for journalists with the anticipated date and the test of unreasonableness. I think that does cover the concerns we expressed.
Okay, good. Mr. Bassett. If we finished on that, then we assume that we can delete the provision in Clause 1, and we're not going to go for the first option under Clause 4A on page 19, but for the second option. Just to get make sure that we okay.
No, that's agreed, Chair. Then just in that wording, though, they have given us some. It's not particularly clean. So you've given us an option. These options of or as account, take into account or consider. I don't know if we need to clean that up ourselves or whether they can just guide us on what they were intending. Through you, Chair.
Chair, sorry, we just gave those as options for consideration, and we don't have any strong preference for each of them. Maybe we could get guidance from the committee. Maybe for purposes of, always sounds the best, but then we've got for two words for purpose. For the purpose of deciding whether the conduct of a respondent is unreasonable, for the purposes of paragraph A, so maybe it would be better, neater from language point of view, for the purpose of deciding whether the conduct of respondent is unreasonable, as referred to in paragraph A, but we are in the committee's hands.
Okay, the latter. Okay, Mr. Bassett, you have that.
There again, we don't have strong views. May be taken into account.
Mr. Roberts.
Okay. The next redraft that was done relates to the powers of the South African police to investigate the instance of harassment. It's on page 15. It's clause 6.1. We were requested to make it certain that the police will act in terms of clause 1A only where a complainant definitely states on the oath or affirmation that she intends applying for a protection order, and that it then appears from that information that there are reasonable grounds for believing that harassment has took place, and that the name and address of the complainant, of the harasser is unknown to the complainant. So that was actually just a redraft of the previous clause, which more or less stated the same.
Okay. Well, they're happy with that. Next, Mr. Robertson.
The next one is not actually a redraft, but we were requested by the committee to inter alia look into firstly the criminalising clause. The criminalising clause is clause 18. Going to give you a page now.
Page what?
It's 27. It starts on page 27, the offences. And I want to refer the committee to clause 18.3. That relates to where the court can actually subpoena a person to attend proceedings or warn a person to attend proceedings, or by way of a subpoena in terms of a subpoena, that a person must produce certain books of documents or objects, that is in terms of clause 7. A failure to do that is criminalised in terms of clause 18.3, and the question was asked of if it's really necessary to put in a specific criminalising clause. I think the argument was that since it is a magistrate court that exercised its discretion, that it is an offence, maybe in terms of the Magistrates Courts Act. We did look through the Magistrates Courts Act. Section 51 of the Magistrates Courts Act make provision for the subpoena of witnesses in terms of the Magistrates Courts Act. And in terms of that specific section, a contravention for not appearing is criminalized under that section. I believe the argument was also that it might amount to contempt of court. We seem to differ from that. We actually looked through all the decided cases and could only find one specific case that says that if you disregard the subpoena, it might amount to common law contempt of court. It was an obiter dictum in a judgment, recent one in 2010. If you look at legislation on the statute book, and there is a lot, where magistrates' courts are imposed certain functions and able to subpoena certain witnesses, and the tendency seems to be that a failure to comply with such a subpoena is criminalized in the main act or the act itself, and not by virtue of incorporation by inter alia the Magistrates Courts Act. I can refer to a couple of legislations, inter alia the implementation of the Rome Statute on the International Criminal Court. Similar, a magistrate has got the powers to subpoena a person, and a contravention or not complying with the subpoena is criminalized by the act itself. Other act that can be used as an argument is in the Criminal Procedure Act. One can argue that a magistrate's court sits as a magistrate's court act in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, and in terms of the procedures of the sections of the Criminal Procedure Act, non-compliance with the subpoena is criminalised in the Criminal Procedures Act itself. So our argument is that it should be criminalised and that we should retain Clause 18.3.
All right. Honourable members? So it stays, eh? Good.
Okay, and the last point for discussion from our part, our side, is actually it relates to the schedule of the bill. The legislation that we amend in the schedule, on page 32, it starts there. We were requested whether it is proper to inter alia amend section 384 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which is legislation that doesn't actually fit into the whole structure of the amendments. It's not actually a consequential amendment, but it's something like a major amendment of a dissimilar act. Authorities on the matter is very scarce. I couldn't find any South African authority on the matter that actually prohibits a person from amending the similar legislation on in a schedule, the state were advisors at some stage issued an opinion to the effect that if one wants to amend certain acts that's not consequential in nature, you cannot do it by way of a schedule. And if you want to amend that legislation, it should be put into primary legislation. That is as far as they take it, actually. They did not say that you cannot amend dissimilar legislation, that this doesn't fit into the part of the main act or the provisions of the main act or the objects of the main act. So it might be problematic in Italia to include section 384 according to the opinion in the schedule. If the committee still wants to proceed with that kind of amendment in accordance with the opinion of the state law advisor, it would rather be better to put it in the main provisions of the act. I don't think they actually said it was incorrect to amend legislation that is not the amendments which is not consequential in nature. It's just that they actually criticised the way in which we do it. Did it?
Okay, Mr. Bassett.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to make it clear. Perhaps I don't think there's a formal opinion. I don't want to create the wrong impression. But we did have discussions with the. Well, I had discussions with the law advisors, and one of the Mr. Sisa Makabeni from the Office of the State Law Advisor is also here, so he might want to talk to the issue. We don't have terribly strong feelings. I would like to argue that the amendments to the bail legislation in the schedule, that's Section 60, to the Firearms Act. Are certainly consequential, and I wouldn't see a problem having them in the schedule. But the most dicey one is domestic violence. I think that might be argued not to be consequential, but really just an improvement to that act. It's also a bit dicey, the amendment to Section 384 of the 1955 Criminal Procedure Act dealing with peace orders. That might also not be seen to be a consequential act in the true provision in the true sense of the word. But as far as those provisions are concerned, the peace orders, the whole purpose of this bill is to create or strengthen the legislative framework to deal with harassing behavior. And the improvement of that provision in the old 1955 Act is part of strengthening the legislative framework. If the committee feels that we shouldn't be interfering with the principle or going against the principle where schedules only contain, strictly speaking, consequential provisions, we could always try and deal with this in our traditional omnibus legislation, which we're bringing to Parliament soon. So it's really up to the committee to decide. I don't know whether Mr. Makabeni would like to say anything on the matter. In conclusion, perhaps I could just say that Thornton, he's one of the experts on legislative drafting, he also says quite clearly, I think, that schedules must really be used for consequential amendments. Thank you.
Mr. Martin.
Thanks, Chair. That was our opinion, Chairperson, that we favour including only mainly consequential amendments in schedules and matters of detail that support the substantive provisions that are in the main Act. So we don't deal with substantive matters in the form of a schedule.
First, JJ, and then.
I think from a policy point of view, it's not correct to use a schedule to make amendments to other things. So I think it would be better if those amendments that are not consequential come out and go into the judicial matters.
All right.
Thank you, Chair. Can we keep then the bail and the firearms in the schedule? Is that what it would boil down to?
Maybe Mr. Bassett can just run through, or Mr. Roberts, or just which ones then?
In the schedule, on the page 32 is the amendments to Section 34 of the Criminal Procedure Act of 1955. Our submission is that this is not a consequential amendment, and we probably need to take that one out. The second one, it's on page 33, that relates to amendment to the current Criminal Procedure Act, and it relates to bail conditions. It's our submission that this might be consequential in nature. Well, to an extent. What we do is we insert a provision in Section 60 of the Criminal Procedure Act, in terms of which the opinion of a person against whom offence has been committed is taken into account. Well, it's actually a borderline case. I have to admit it.
Chair, I think it relates to the criteria that a court must take into account when deciding whether or not to grant bail. And what is being suggested here, the court should take into account whether there's been harassment.
Chair, this whole bill doesn't relate to criminal conduct, actually. It only becomes criminal conduct if we get a harassment order and if they don't comply. And I really think it's... I mean, I like the provision, but I think we need to put it in the other act.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't think it's borderline. I mean,
it's removed.
Yeah.
Okay. On page 33, the last one, it's Domestic Violence Act. This where provision is made for the subpoenaing of witness in domestic violence matters. Well, it's not consequential, I suppose. It's true. On page 34, amendment to the Firearms Control Act, that is a strictly consequential amendment. That relates to inter alia, if a person's firearm is confiscated in terms of the bill. The First Amendment to Section 102, that paragraph inserted therein, will actually give the register the powers to hold an inquiry into the competence of a person to possess a firearm. The second one, although Schedule 2 of the Firearms Control Act is amendment, it relates to Section 103, where the court may hold an inquiry to decide on the competence of a person if he has contravened a protection order for purposes of the bill. This is a strictly consequential amendment, it should stay.
Yeah, I agree. So I think then in effect it's only one amendment in the schedule, that's the one on the Firearms Act.
The one on domestic violence also comes out?
Yeah.
Okay, that's removed as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it doesn't mean we don't...
To agree with the amendments, it's
sure.
A question of they're in the wrong place and they need to be in judicial matters.
All right. Are we clear then, Mr. Bassett?
Thank you, Chair.
Yes?
There are just a few technical amendments. I think Mr. Roberts has finished with what he needs to say.
Before you start, Mr. Bassett,
before we get onto the technical issues, there was one other outstanding matter which the committee hadn't resolved, and that was what we want to do with the regulations. And Chair, that was the issue of, I see that the research section, or Christine, has done a table detailing the amendments, but the issue basically is, do we want as Parliament to approve the regulations, or do we want to simply have them tabled before they are introduced? I don't have particularly strong feelings on the matter, but my concern is once we give ourselves the power to approve, we've seen from other legislation that we've done that for, the Child Justice Act particularly, is it's quite a lot of work and involves a number of meetings. And I think in the case of the Child Justice Act, it was new law, and I think we need to look at whether it warrants that attention, that scrutiny from the committee. I mean, we've got trafficking. We may find, I would have argued, trafficking is more relevant to approve than this. Yeah, but I don't have strong feelings.
Okay.
Well, our submission is that most of the regulations in terms of the bill is procedural in nature. It doesn't actually relate to a kind of policy decision that needs to be made. So, well, we haven't got strong feelings on it either, but it's our submission, since no policy is involved here, that it can just be submitted to Parliament. That relates to the peer regulations, the prescripts that must be issued by the Director General of Justice, the South African Police Service, and the National Prosecuting Authority is more of also procedural in nature, but that may, to an extent, maybe require some kind of policy approval. But again, this can just be submitted to Parliament, and if Parliament does not agree with that, obviously it can, it will be set right afterwards.
Okay. I think you've heard the members. It can just be submitted. There's no need to actually say we must approve. Okay. All right. What else is there?
I could just take you through, just on three pages, there's some technical amendments that I'd like to bring to your attention on page 5. They're very small.
Yes.
In the definition of respondent, paragraph B, I think I must read for the purposes of sections 4, 5, and 6.
Okay, sections. Okay.
And on page 18, subsection 4 of section of clause 8, I think it should read before the court acts in terms of subsection 1, 2, or 3. And then there was another one. And the other one is on page 26. It's clause 15, paragraph A, as directed by the court in terms of section 3, 3A or 4, section 4, 2, comma, section 5, 2, or section 9, 5, just to be consistent. So I'm just adding the word, I'm suggesting the inclusion of the word section before 5, 2. And that's it. Thank you, Chair.
Oh, I see. All right. I take it then we're done.
Chair, yes, that's everything besides the objects memo.
Objects memo?
No, may I make one inquiry? By way of a footnote. I see that in your paperwork during your deliberations you looked at the Protection of Personal Information Bill, which some of us are currently working on, and that you have as an annexure C the further processing limitation. Was this just something you brought into consideration while looking at this bill? Because I see that it in fact is all right. There is no conflict between the two. But there is another aspect of the CPI, which, Chair, through you, I'd just like to bring to the Honourable Jeffrey's attention. The requirement for prior investigation by the information regulator in clause 55 there has a provision in 55.1b that would worry me and that perhaps we could mop up when we finalise this act, namely that the regulator has to do some prior investigation before the processing of information on criminal behaviour or unlawful or objectionable conduct on behalf of third parties. Had you perhaps had a chance to look at that? But I would suggest we look at that when we finish the other bill. My question is it that you simply looked at the further processing limitation? That clause is attached as annexure C. No.
I think it's can't even remember that we did submit to Juliet.
It's applicable, but it's all right because there is an exemption which would take care of harassment.
Now, we were at one stage asked to refer into idea or to take into account the Protection of Personal Information Act the further processing of a person's information that related to inter alia
the current
clause 4,
yes.
Which provide that a mobile cellular operator may give certain information to the court, and it was in relation to that we actually did take it into account and consider it, and we came to the conclusion that the protection of the PPI bill does not prohibit that.
I agree. But I think that the other one is something we should look at, but we can do it separately.
All right. Anything else, honourable members? Yes, Debbie.
Just a point of discussion and for my own whatever. I'm just still slightly concerned about the broadness of the definition of harassment read together with harm, because especially when it comes to things like loitering and watching and looking, there's no requirement that it has to be sort of persistent. Now, if you can satisfy me that in the context of the court's deliberation, you know, decision-making process, that they will actually take that into account, then that's okay. I mean, do you think it's sufficiently covered by reasonableness and unreasonableness? Because, you know, you don't want to, because the definition of harm is also pretty broad, with economic harm and emotional and psychological, I'm just concerned that that kind of behavior could still be brought within the realms of this bill.
Sorry, now, is the problem the broadness of the definition?
The broadness of the definition of harassment when it comes to things like loitering and following and watching somebody. I mean, if somebody is complaining that a journalist is standing outside their house, can that be brought in within the definition of this, given that it can also be psychological harm? Or, as somebody else said, what about, you know, a street person hanging around your house, could that now be used to say, well, they're bringing economic harm to me because it's bringing down the value of my property, that kind of thing?
Well, besides, I think it's a very broad definition, and conduct inside our loitering, where you actually watch a person and things like that will be included. I'm sorry? Well, the problem is, if we actually restrict the definition, the consequences, certain adverse consequences will most probably follow. Like, you can either restrict it by inter alia providing that a certain amount of conduct must take place, but then you get extreme cases of harassment that is a one ongoing conduct. But watching, let's say I play something like a video recording of somebody's shower or bedroom, maybe. Well, a single instance of that obviously should qualify as that. That is just a problem if you try to define the boundaries of harassment. And our submission is that the court must take all the circumstances into account and then determine whether it's reasonable. Sometimes, you know, like a person walking past somebody's house and just look at their house, I'm sure a reasonable court will come to the reasonable conclusion that it's not unreasonable.
JJ?
I think it's covered because is a requirement that all these activities, the watching, the ones that we're dealing with, the watching, the following the watching, the loitering, must be unreasonable. So it's not ordinary watching. I mean, I'm watching you. That's not unreasonable. And then there's a further requirement of that it causes harm or inspires a reasonable belief, not a belief, a reasonable belief. So it's an objective test that it will cause harm. So I think it's sufficiently limited.
Yes, ma'am.
If I may as well, the question that was posed was about persistence too, and whether one had to have an element of repetition, for example, and we looked into that quite in depth. We also looked at comparative legislation where they have started off with having repetition in their definitions and then moving to a once-off act being sufficiently being sufficient to actually get an order just on one act. So one has to once again balance that with the unreasonableness. But persistence, it was found, can lead to a lot of unclearness. How many acts makes persistence, and then you have all that unclarity, you know, unclearness that goes with that.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not too sure whether the suggestion by the committee to include that the respondent knows or ought to know might also have some sort of, wouldn't it have a limiting?
All right. Okay. Is that it?
Chair, I don't know that if we're going to go on to the objectives, the memorandum of objectives, should we not finish the bill first, because that memorandum describes the bill. So I don't know then whether we should be going through, are we going to vote now? I mean, because I think then it seems that we are ready, although we may want to go through it page by page to look at whether we're happy with the amendments. I don't know. I don't know what other members of the committee feel.
I would suggest
we finish with the bill before we look at the memorandum of objectives, which is just a description of the bill.
Yeah. Steve. Start voting. Dean? Yeah. JP? Are you okay? All right. Prof?
Go ahead.
Okay. Yes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We have a quorum.
Okay. I don't know what the quorum is. Most two members, and I don't know whether to be a person or not, but yeah, we're okay now.
All right. Okay. All right, honourable members. Let's start with clause 1. You want us to start with a long title? Alright, let's start with a long title then. That's page.
Do we not do motions of desirability anymore? Aren't that part of the rules anymore?
No. Done away with it. Yeah. I don't know when they did away with it. They didn't like them. Yeah, well, let's think. I think it's a case of change being difficult to accept, JB. JJ?
The long title will now change because of us dropping the amendments at the bottom. To effect consequential amendments to the Criminal Procedure Act to amend the Domestic Violence Act and provide for a mechanism to subpoena witnesses to attend proceedings in terms of that act, those would come out.
Because, yeah, we've taken them out. Okay. That comes out. So it's only the one dealing with the Firearms Control Act that stays in, eh?
So, Chair, it would read to provide for the issuing of protective orders against harassment to effect consequential amendments to the Fire Control Act and to provide for matters connected therewith. That's what it would boil down to.
Yeah. Okay. We have that? Steve?
Agreed.
There's many clauses. Are we? I would want to suggest that there's deemed approval, unless anyone says anything. I don't know. But if you're going to go through each clause and say agreed, why not sort of run through each clause and unless members object? I don't know. Just trying to be helpful.
When do we go around deeming things left, right, and centre? When did we abandon actual process?
Okay, deem, you can vote.
All right, let's vote then.
Chair, I vote in. Can I propose, do you need a seconder, that we support the long title as amended?
Mr. Bassey. Chair, sorry, I don't want to interfere. We also prepared the A version where the formal amendments, and I'm not too sure whether that has to be dealt with. It's ready, but we've got to make adjustments as a result of today's discussion.
Tomorrow? Honourable members? Yeah. That was our program to formally vote tomorrow. The gentleman who I had asked to be here is very apologetically said, no, the process you're following is correct. And that was what we were going to do, you know, just go through this B-list today, final amendments, and then have the A-list tomorrow. JJ? Okay? All right. Mr. Bassett?
Yeah, what we can do, it's not going to take us long. We can go and clean up this bill, and then we can give it to, send it through to Mr. Romano, so that that's, you can at least see that, and we'll do the A-list as well. It's virtually finished. It just needs some fine-tuning now as a result of today's stuff.
Okay. Good. Yeah, the committee section, honourable members, had instructed Mr. Romano that we had to add an additional step to our procedure, and that was their decision. So he politely said, okay, phone the chair. So the gentleman concerned phoned me and says, we've decided. I said, no, you don't have any authority to decide anything of that kind. Yes, but you see, there were mistakes made in another piece of legislation. And I said, no, that's neither here nor there. That recommendation you take to the Rules Committee or the Joint Rules Committee. Let them decide. Otherwise, we're going to find ourselves changing willy-nilly by officials and not by the proper authority. But I think once Mr. Romano had explained our process to him, he realized that we weren't going to fall into that particular trap. So let's go this route and then be absolutely certain what it is we're approving tomorrow. Okay? Okay. All right. Anything else, Mr. Bassett, before we move on to other matters? Oh, yes, the memorandum.
Can I take the committee through?
Yes.
Page 1 of the memorandum. The reference to the Protection of Harassment Bill 2010 has been amended to read 2011. That is in the first paragraph as well as the heading.
Sorry, just on the memorandum now, the first paragraph on the purpose would also be amended by us dropping those things on the on the schedule.
Yes, Criminal Procedure Act, Domestic Violence Act, etc. Well,
okay, then on the...
I'm being asked why you're making it 2011 and not and removing 2010.
Chair, the bill is 2010. The act will be 2011, or if the NCOP sits on it, 2012 or
2013. Okay. All right. That wasn't meant for the media.
Page 2, the first line, the word briefly taken out, and then in the second line we amended or inserted the words the respondent knows or ought to know to make provision for the Bavuza amendment, and then also at the second star that appears on page 2 we inserted the committee's recommendation that sexual harassment is also part of the definition of harassment. Then on a reference to clause 1.3, that can be taken out. That was inserted as an option. On page 3, clause 3.3, C, the word protection has been inserted. Then further down that paragraph, where the sentence starts with an interim protection order takes effect the moment, served has been struck out, and
The following words has been inserted, issued by the court, and existence thereof has been brought to the attention of. And then after respondent, we struck out and then make it a new sentence. Again, then on page 3, we inserted clause 4, which made provision for the tracing of cyber harassers. Clause 3.5 is on page 4, we insert that. That relates to clause 5, where the court may order the police to investigate matters of harassment. We have inserted that, it goes over to page 5. And then a new clause 3.6, where we discuss clause 6, which provide for a discretionary power of the South African police to investigate harassment and also to further regulate the powers of the South African police in terms of direction that is issued by the court in terms of clause 5. Then clause 4, that is paragraph 3.7, clause 4, renumber it. We make provision for the court to warn a person. We actually just extended it as was previously, so nothing actually changed there.
Can I just ask, top of page 4, line 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 down, what is 5 ordinary court days? It's either 5 ordinary days or 5 court days, not 5 ordinary court days.
Okay, there was a definition inserted by us relating to court days in the bill. Ordinary court days, the term already appeared in terms of the bill as introduced. It's still there. If one look at, it's not defined though. It just referred to the term ordinary court days. Ordinary court day is a day when a court usually sits, excluding a Saturday, Sunday, or a public holiday. Yeah, that's a court day, ordinary court day.
What's the difference?
Chair, this, I don't know whether the members will recall, we had, as Sol said, we had a definition of court day in and we were asked to take it out. And when we took it out, in the provisions of the bill, instead of referring to court days, we referred to ordinary court days to try and differentiate, because I think this was a request from the service providers to say they don't want to land up in a situation where they've got to give the information to the court within 4 days. And they wanted to make sure that it's working days, because in terms of this legislation, I think the court can be convened on weekends and after hours and all sorts of things. So we want to make it clear. So it's really for the service providers, so that they have Monday to Friday. Those are the 4 days within which to give the direct information required in the direction.
All right. Let it go. Well, you're very nice to him when he's going to support you.
Page 5, paragraph 3.8. In clause 5, is renumbered to clause 8. And additional sentence is inserted. Where court has been given a discretion to afford persons to apply to the court to be present at proceedings where you exclude persons from the proceedings or where the proceedings is held in camera. Paragraph 3.9, it's on page 5, clause 6, renumbered to 9. Page 6. Further amendment is at the end of that paragraph. It starts with provision is further made And the fire protection order will only remain in force for a period of 5 years. Okay, second paragraph 310, renumbering of clause 7 to clause 10. This provides for the exclusion of the South African police from the offences clause in the bill. Page 6 again, paragraph 311. Clause 8 is renumbered to clause 11. Mm-hmm. Page 7, paragraph 312, clause 9 is renumbered to clause 12. And also the definition or the phrase armed or dangerous is taken out due to the fact that we did amend the definition by including armed and dangerous weapon under the definition of weapon. Page 7, paragraph 313, clause 10 is renumbered to clause 13. Paragraph 314, clause 11 is numbered to clause 14. 315, clause 12, renumbered to clause 15. Paragraph 316, clause 13 renumbered to clause 16. Paragraph 3.17, renumbering of clause 14 to clause 17. 318, renumbering of clause 15 to 18, and paragraph B is inserted as a summary of the offences that can be created by electronic communication service providers, that it follows over to page 8. That paragraph F at the bottom is just beyond the line in toto. Okay, then on page 8 still, paragraph 319, clause 16 renumbered to 19. Paragraph 320, clause 17 renumbered to 20. Okay, the word and is struck out, and what the major thing that has been asserted as the issuing of directives by the Director General for clerks of the court to comply with the Act. And then 321, we take out paragraph A, paragraph B, paragraph C, and then add to paragraph D. That will be the paragraph to make amendments to the Firearms Control Act. That will be inserted, probably be a bit redrafted now. Then on page 9, paragraph 6, the third line of the paragraph, just the substitution of the word that with those, and that is it.
So really the amendments that have been proposed, the insertions really more than anything else, are a summary of the provisions that have been changed or added to the bill.
Okay.
It's fine, but I know it's in the rules, but I really disagree with us having to approve a document which is not ours. Because, for example, implementation plan, it says here the implementation of the bill does not require any detailed implementation plans. Is that correct? Worse than department and parties consulted. Now there's no reference to our hearings, because this is the memorandum coming with the bill. So, Chair, I think I'm shouting in the wind. We have to, in terms of the rules, do it. But I think we need to, as the ridiculous motion of desirability. You spend months discussing a bill, and then you take a resolution right at the end that it's desirable. As that has gone, I think this requirement that the objectives needs to be approved is something that should be proposed as a rule change.
All right. Well,
having said that, I support the amendments to the memorandum.
Okay.
Objects, anyone, subject to those qualifications.
Anyone with objections? No. All agreed? No. No. All right, good. So everyone's in favor. Okay. We're done. Okay, and we'll see you tomorrow.
We usually do a report. We're not saying anything on report. I don't know if we've got anything to say.
Well, it doesn't seem like there is a need for a report. No.
I think the committee report is that we approve the bill with amendments, but I think usually we don't have to say we want the department to look at this or that or anything else. I don't think anything came up.
Did we not maybe mention the judicial, that we would like to see the other amendments in the judicial matters amendment?
Here's your report. Yes.
Chair, and there was something else that the committee mentioned. I don't know how strongly they feel. There's no criminalisation for a person who, for a complainant who makes a false statement. And I think it was... because it's also like that in the Domestic Violence Act, and I recall the committee having said perhaps that's something that needs to be revisited.
Yeah. You want to interject? All right, you can speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Apologies for the late arrival, but I think that's a relevant point, and if I can just a clarity on my understanding, because we are not dealing with any conduct which is tantamount to a crime, the false allegation of harassment would not be tantamount to criminal injuria. Am I correct?
Yeah.
So the victim of a falsely lodged or even a maliciously lodged complaint would not have the resort to criminal injuria, and they would be dealing in a situation where damages are very difficult to prove. So I think that that's a relevant issue that we should... if it is relevant, we should deal with it now, and I understand it comes... late in the process, but I don't see Parliament reapplying its mind to this matter with the legislative agenda ahead.
We've dealt with this. You're taking us back. No, we've dealt with this. We've debated it at length, and we've reached conclusions, and Mr. Ambrosini is taking us back. Yeah. Okay. You don't have to answer. We note what you've said. Anything else before we shut it until tomorrow?
Who's doing the report? Is it the committee section or the team? Or is it the party?
It's done by Parliament.
Turned by Parliament, which means Christine. Yeah. All right. Okay. That's it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bassett, Mr. Robertson, Ms. Clark, and my thanks to Mr. Jeffrey, Mrs. Schaefer, and other members, as well as the media, for their very late engagement and input. We appreciate it. I thought I should make that point, because it was at the back of our minds, and so we needed that extra engagement. I'm absolutely convinced that they will. But don't expect screaming headlines. Well, okay.
Excuse
me. Yes. You're welcome to sit, but... All right. couple of housekeeping matters before I recognize Dean Smuts. I have received a memorandum from Mr. Frolic, House Chairperson. Request: following instruments are outstanding on the program of committee, that's the Justice Portfolio Committee. One, request from the Public Protector in terms of Section 2, Sub 5 of the Public Protector Act for the NA, that's the National Assembly, to review and redetermine the remuneration and other terms and conditions of employment of the Deputy Public Protector. Mr. Romano, they were supposed to give us a report. Yes. Have they done that?
They did, but the one that I said wasn't complete. I requested them to send another one. I put it in the script, but so far, I but I am liaising with them.
Okay, fine. Then two, code of good conduct. Oh, code of good conduct. Tables in terms of Section 10, Sub 5A of the Promotion of Administrative Justice. I'm not sure what that is. Do you know? Oh.
No.
Promotion of Administrative Justice Act.
Oh, that thing has been long outstanding.
Christine, can you help there? Sorry.
In fact, Mr. Bassett helped me on behalf of one of the law professors. This thing is long outstanding.
Let's hear Christine.
We did consider it, and then we sent it back to the department because we weren't happy with the code.
The department wasn't happy.
No, we.
We weren't. The committee wasn't. Okay.
Running late by however many years. We really must try to do something about it.
Why do they call it code of good conduct? Just a... Well... All right, Christine?
What I can do is I'll put together a memo of exactly what we considered, and I think I had some documents in that.
And we need to do some chasing up, I think.
Yeah.
All right. Because he's asking me for a progress report here. And so let's do that chasing up, and once we've done that, I'll send him something in writing, please. Okay. And I've got a follow-up on this. This is done. That's done. That's personal. This is something else. I've also asked Mr. Romano, Christine, the bills that have been tabled, we receive briefings on them sometime next week. And following those briefings, committee must decide whether we want to advertise calling for written submissions on each of them. There's a fair number. Okay. I understand we now have a constitutional, an 18th amendment.
Federalism? Take away from us.
No. All right. That's it. Now. Child justice. Oh, yes. Honourable members, Mr. Romano's just reminded me. Sorry, Mr. Jeffrey. There are NGOs and bodies who are monitoring the implementation of the Child Justice Act. They've requested to be part of our deliberations next week and to actually make input. And so my question to you is that okay with you? It's not normally done, but I'm putting it to you. It's fine? Okay. Not the whole world, though.
Are they going to give us a written document? Do we know?
I'll request them to send us something.
Well, they might just want to have input. So yeah, we're not sure what confidential that they want to.
Yeah, because we're asking the department to give us a briefing on the implementation, and Mr. Romano feels that this is the appropriate time for them to also so that we don't have a sweet out report from the department.
It's limited to those who made input on the original bill, perhaps.
Yes.
Well, and then give some submissions up front as what the suggested, and you can decide.
See, that's what I'm afraid of, that once they hear, then, you know, we don't want...
No, let them give written submissions. You can decide then whether who we want to talk to.
JJ, and then Steve.
I was going to say, there's something called the Child Justice Alliance, which is a sort of conglomerate of a number of NGOs. I think I don't know who's approached the committee secretary, but I suggest it be through that umbrella body.
Okay. For now.
So that was what I was going to say. And Skelton, Jackie Gallinetti, those
we know.
Judy Slot Nielsen. Those are the three that form the main part of that. And in fact, Anne Skelton helped us with the drafting of the bill the whole time. So we don't need to open it to everyone. It's obviously the people that have asked to come. Let's ask them, do they want to make a written submission?
Okay. But anyone else, we block.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Otherwise, sure. All right. You've got that, eh? Debbie?
Jay, I just want to raise the issue of the, as far as I understand, the criminal procedure amendments fall under this committee. Is that so? Because if it's not so, then I don't have to raise the issue. But if it is so, then I do. It ought to be so.
Which amendments?
Well, any amendments of the Criminal Procedure Act, do they come to justice?
I normally do, yes.
Because my concern is that the forensics bill, criminal procedure amendment in respect of forensics,
yes,
it's being dealt with by police.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask whether we should perhaps be doing it jointly with them. Because I know now, the fingerprint is finished, but now they're still busy with the DNA issue. And should we not be involved with that as well?
They hijacked it. Oh. Oh, you don't want to go.
May I support Ms. Schaefer there? Especially when you get to DNA, there are fundamental rights at issue, and it is quite an interesting but difficult debate. There's at least one European Court of Human Rights judgment, MARPA, which is relevant. And I have been lobbied by, there's a big split and dispute in the scientific / legal community about what ought to be done. And I've been lobbied in particular by, never mind who, by people in KZN, but by people who feel very strongly that there is police abuse of forensic evidence and who can tell riveting tales. On the other side are the people who have been agitating for, and I support them in that, for the quick amendment of the CPA to modernize it so that we can use DNA. Of course, there's no question of the utility. But the implications in terms of fundamental human rights are quite difficult. The potential for police abuse, I believe, is there. I have a really vivid argument. And I do think it would be desirable that we sit together with that committee, however pressed we always are for time.
All right. Can we leave it to you? I'll ask Mr. Romano to confer with his counterpart on the Police Portfolio Committee and see what can be done in that regard. All right. Mr. Jeffrey?
I just wanted to know about the judges' conference. When do we get details?
Yes.
Or are we meant to be all sort of sitting at home hoping that we're going to get invited?
Well, I know that Mr. Romano did approach me with regard to one or two concerns. The members who are here constitute members who attend regularly. However, there are those who are listed as committee members who seldom, if ever, attend. And Mr. Romano's question to me was, do they also go to this conference?
Yeah.
All right. There you have your answer. Are we agreed they don't go? All right. So, tell us. Hey?
Absolutely.
You abstain?
Because we haven't attended, so.
You're looking at everything all at once.
No, no,
so you're in no danger.
That's not the reason why I think.
It's your colleague you're concerned about.
Yes.
Maybe what I can report is that I submitted applications for political approval last year, and the chief they have approved. And then I'm only waiting for financial approval from the division manager. I've tried to book a hotel which is a walking distance from the Hilton Hotel, so it will be in Southern Sandton. It's a walking distance, so everything has been arranged. I'm just waiting for the final authorization from division manager. Then, but maybe one thing that I would request from members, since it would be constituency period, I'm not so sure as to where they will be living from. I have approached some of them, but I was not able to get hold of, I think, Honorable Jeffrey, the chairperson, and Mr. Swart as well, I think. Most of them I've been able to. To talk to them. So maybe just as an indication.
So those of you that Mr. Romano has not been able to contact, it's with regard to where you will be during the recess. So he needs that information, Mr. Jeffrey.
The chair is going to suggest that if we don't get financial approval for this, that we then look at a study trip to maybe Australia.
Or yes, yes. Yeah, South America?
Yeah.
Yes, I agree.
Seriously, though, can it be speeded up? I mean, we haven't been doing any study trips, so, I mean, it should be a straightforward application.
No, we haven't.
Next year.
Oh, you do know that the House Chair has allocated periods of the year for study tours. And we've been allocated November, December, which effectively is winter in the Northern Hemisphere.
Hawaii.
Brazil, yes, okay, all right. All right.
Mr. Chairman,
I didn't recognize you.
All right. And I haven't spoken, I said, Mr. Chairman.
All right, let me hear you.
No, I mean, it's. I have a sort of a standing objection to this study tour.
Go.
I wrote an article and published an article in 79 on the Spanish Constitution and one on the National Environmental Policy Act in the States, working from Italy and going to the library. If we want to take a study, this is before the internet. If we want to take a study tour, let's go to the library.
Chairman, you know that's absolute nonsense. We meet the people and exchange ideas, and you come home with chicken.
Enriched.
Can we drop this subject?
After you've answered you.
Chair, somebody's being very inconsistent. I won't say who, but I mean, I got lobbied about trying to take the protection of personal information to some foreign country by a particular person. So
I'm sure you do.
Consistency.
Yes.
A month ago it was Berlin. Yes.
All right. Okay.
Okay.
Well, now, the Honorable Dean Smuts. Please, whoa. I don't want a long speech. Very succinctly, tell us what you want.
Sir, and now, please, in the most deadly earnest and seriousness. A difficult situation has arisen as a result of the President's decision to use the Judges Remuneration Act to extend the Chief Justice's term and the challenge which is being mounted by certain legal NGOs to the use of that law for the extension of the term of the CJ. And so what is undesirable about this situation is that it puts the Chief Justice in contention and that his brethren and sisters must now sit in judgment on his term. I will say to you that I find it, in fact, quite unbearable. And what we want to propose to you is that we, as the Justice MPs, could resolve this situation by
putting before the House, as a committee, let's put before the House either a one-line committee bill extending the term of the Chief Justice by 5 years, that would be an ad hominem Act of Parliament, or alternatively, putting before the House a bill providing, for example, that where a Chief Justice has served less than 5 years, fewer than 5 years, his term shall not terminate before he has served 5 years in that office. There are more than one way to do this. But we feel very strongly that we must do something, because such a bill, which then becomes an act of this Parliament, puts the Chief Justice's position beyond dispute. It leaves the NGOs free to take their action to get Section 8 of the Remuneration Act struck down. So the DA supported the Remuneration Act at the time it was passed. It was written in particular circumstances. It deals with pensions and benefits. We are, however, on record since early this year that Section 176(1) ought to be used for the extension of the term of judge and corporal, because 176 asks for an Act of Parliament, not that an appointment should be extended under an Act of Parliament. It is preferable. And let me just say, in conclusion, everyone clearly is acting in good faith. The presidency or government acting in good faith, the NGOs acting in good faith, but this dispute itself is becoming unhealthy. Already I see a commentator like Eusebius McKaiser writes, Azuma se besluit terzijde gesteld worden door die constitutionele hof, en ik zal geld verbieden dat het wel de geval zal zijn. I wouldn't necessarily. Voorspel ik dat de gedienstige ANC eenvoudig die nodige wet zal aanvaarden om Kobo's termijn te verlengen. It is being politicized. It is being suggested that should the challenge succeed, and if Parliament puts an act through, that that would be an ANC act and a by gedienstige LPS. Well, we say as opposition MPs, in principle, the situation is unhealthy, it must not be politicized, the Chief Justice must not be put in contention, and therefore we implore you as the Justice Committee, don't give us an answer now, but please consider whether we cannot so act and put this dispute away and ensure that the CJ's standing is not affected, because it is intolerable that it is being brought into contention.
Let me hear you.
It's just offer to say don't answer now. Consider it. I will not consider it before we answer without applying our mind to it. It's my view.
Right. Mr. Ambrosini, Mr. Swart, Prof. Ndavanda. I've heard you, JB.
Mr. Chairman, I echo what the Honourable Smart has said, first and foremost on the need of conducting this debate in earnest and with the seriousness that the matter demands. I agree with what has been said. I just want to make a couple of qualifications. First, we must appreciate that the requirement of serving without fear, prejudice or favour requires that not justice may expect any favor from the executive. The decision by a member of the executive of whether or not to extend the term of office of a justice and the extent to which it needs to be extended, it's repugnant to the very notion of independence of the Constitutional Court. For this reason, the Constitution originally said 12 years non-renewable, and that is in line with all the other constitutional courts, including the Austrian, the German, the Italian, and the Spanish constitutional law. And there where constitutional adjudication is exercised in the United States and Canada, where judges serve on a lifetime and their term of office cannot be tinkered with. We then amended the Constitution to say that it can be extended by an act of parliament which extends the term of office of a judge. A act of parliament extends the term of office of a judge, 176. And that's consistent because the executive doesn't touch it. Parliament does it. I think that was an unwise amendment because it reduces the independence, but it is an amendment to the Constitution nonetheless, and we are bound by it. So what the Honorable Smax is suggesting is necessary. Only the first option. The second option I submit is not consistent with the Constitution because it would be an act of Parliament which would detract from the clear language of 176.1. It would not be an act of Parliament which does it, but it would be done by somebody else under an act of Parliament. There is urgency to this matter. This matter is snowballing. I've been approached myself by a group of senior advocates who would wish me to join as an applicant or amicus curiae, and I'm sure that other members of this committee have been approached or will be approached. I would like at this meeting, and I accept, first of all, thank you for giving us the opportunity to table this issue. I would like to formally table a resolution on a draft bill before this committee for your consideration, not today, but whenever you wish, for urgent action. There is a point that I think there is not sufficient clarity, but perhaps the Honorable Jeffrey can also provide an input if we are to follow that matter, that route, whether or not we need to have the permission of the National Assembly to introduce the bill via the Committee for Private Members Bill, or whether a committee does not need to have that permission. We have different readings, but that's a technical aspect on how to go about doing it, if there is a willingness to actually do it. But I really think that this is one of the most important aspects, and I also want to place on record that our party has absolutely no problems with the merits of the decision. We are in favor of extending it. It was the right thing to do, but the process must fit this occasion and must fit any other occasion in which the circumstances may be different. Steve.
Thank you, Chair. Very briefly, we also support the Honourable Dean Smuts and what the previous speakers have said. We do find the application of Section 18 in these circumstances problematic. Again, recording, it's not about the candidate, who's a man of the highest integrity and done incredible good work in the justice sphere. But in our view, as the constitutional professor Pierre de Force has said, it's not in the interests of the judiciary that the president should determine the office of the Chief Justice, giving those powers and extending that. And it does, as Professor De Force indicates, it paves the way for suspicious individuals to speculate whether a Chief Justice might make a ruling in favour of the executive to ensure his term of office. That's the type of suspicions that can arise. So that is one of the reasons why we would like the committee to seriously consider this one-liner. It is a way to avoid constitutional litigation. We've done it in the past. I think it was the stay in judgment on the appeals where we as a committee brought legislation. In my 12 years, we have done it in the past, and I think the rules do give us that authority. Rule 238, where it's a bill initiated by an assembly committee, we then approach the speaker. There is a provision there. I've got the rule here in front of us. We don't have to, if there's consideration, and I would ask the majority party not necessarily to take a decision now, but to seriously consider what we are proposing as the opposition parties here to alleviate the uncertainty, as the Honourable Dean Smuts has very strongly argued, the precarious position that the Chief Justice has, and to make it very clear. And we would then emphasise the separation of powers by the Act in terms of Section 176 of the Constitution. So briefly, Chair, I would earnestly implore the majority party to consider what we are proposing as a way of resolving what the majority party might not necessarily see as a problem, but which other parties and NGOs and members of society do see as a problem, Chair. Thank you very much.
Prof, and then John Jeffrey.
Thank you, Chair. I also
listened very carefully to one of those notes, and I think it is indeed a serious matter. But having said that, Chair, I feel that it is food for thought. It's not a matter we can decide on today. Therefore, we must take this as an assignment. Maybe in the next meeting we can come up with a solution.
JJ, followed by Ms. Sheila Stolle.
Chair, I mean, I think the support from the parties for the extension of the term of office of Judge Nlobo is to be welcomed. I mean, it's maybe something that we should look at the National Assembly passing a resolution to indicate. But the point of the matter is, I mean, the problem is, not so much the problem, but the situation is the President has acted. Okay, he's acted in terms of existing law. One could argue that, you know, the law that Dr. Ambrosini refers to a judge. Well, the President has acted in terms of a law which specifies a judge, that is the Chief Justice, the power of the President to extend the term of office of the Chief Justice. This situation's come about because the Constitutional Court, I mean, when the Constitution was drafted, the Chief Justices did not come from the Constitutional Court. They were the heads of the Supreme Court of Appeal, and they therefore had tenure, which was not bound by this 12 years with a Constitutional Court judge. And it's come about because subsequent to that, the head of the Constitutional Court became the Chief Justice, and that's where Chief Justice Cheskelson ran into problems too. It is unfortunate that bodies are seeking to take the matter to court, because it does put the Chief Justice in a difficult position. But that's their right. That's what they've chosen to do. Passing this bill is not going to stop that case. The case can only be stopped if the President decides to withdraw his action. And he believes, and he consulted on the matter, as far as I understand, that he was acting legally correctly. So it's not going to stop that issue. And I mean, the point of the matter is that other judges' terms of office can be extended in terms of the existing law, constitutional court judges from 12 to 15 years. And I think there's an issue relating to the retirement age can be extended as well. It's not a new issue. The bottom line is that the President appoints the Chief Justice. Okay? There are provisions for it to be after consultation with political parties, but the power of appointment of the Chief Justice is with the President, with the head of state. So really, look, I mean, I don't know if there is any point in, I mean, Ms. Smuts can pursue it through a private member's, through the private member's committee. But I can't see us agreeing to this, because the President acted in terms of the law. If a court, other parties have chosen seem to be choosing to take that matter to court. We don't really know why, because the if there were uncertainties in the law, they could have been dealt with in the Superior Courts Bill that is before Parliament now. Maybe they're impressing their funders or whatever. So, Chair, I don't really see any point in this proposal, and I wouldn't support it as a committee bill. If Ms. Smuts wants to then bring it as a private member's bill, then that's her right as well, and that can be done.
JB's proposal that we think on it?
It has been discussed.
All right. Ma'am.
We have agreed that position.
Wait. Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. I don't have the legal expertise to actually express myself on the rightness or the what, but what I heard Dean Smart saying is to me maybe kind of well intended, and the only problem that I have is when my friend here next door emphasizes that opposition parties, because I don't like that. I would like him to say this woman, who, because you know this thing of hiding the brilliance of women is a bit problematic in the history of South Africa. It is Dean Smart who is a woman who came with that brilliance, and it should be stated like that. Thank you.
I would want to move that we don't consider it, that if Ms. Fats wants to take it to the private members committee, she can do that. I think her intentions are good, and we support those intentions, but I don't think there's any point in continuing to have it as an agenda item here.
Okay. I say how greatly we regret that, and we will discuss this amongst ourselves.
All right.
And Mr. Chairman, just to be noted that I request that since there is a formal motion by the Honourable Jeffrey, which I understand is passed, I don't know whether we need to vote on it, but it's not, it seems clear that you do have to vote if you vote all together. For purposes of the minutes of these proceedings, that the resolution and the bill, the draft bill that the Honourable Smart was referring to, be tabled and made part of the record.
Can I just, if you want to put the motion for Martin, then...
Yeah, I think I must do that, because I don't have any draft bill in front of me, and the motion is before us now.
Since the motion is rejecting something...
Yes.
Please do allow that something to be formally tabled.
No. That something was... As Ms. Smart said, please allow us to draft a bill and place it before this committee for approval and then be taken to the NA. You are now saying we want the opportunity to table the bill, and Mr. Jeffrey is saying no.
Mr. Chairman, the bill was sent to you yesterday, was sent to the Honorable Jeffrey yesterday. It's a one-line bill. She did not say allow us to draft it. It says allow us to pass it. Let's pass it. I mean, it was a formal resolution. It's a one-line bill, which says the term of office, so that there is clarity, because it is unavoidable that what we do here and what we say here will be part could become part of the record of constitutional litigation if that proceeds to the constitutional venue. The Justice Committee
Let me stop you there. That is precisely what I was concerned about. I didn't want this Justice Portfolio Committee to be made part of the legal process of the application. Myself. Mr. Jeffrey is correct. Those taking the application forward are perfectly entitled to do so. And now you want these proceedings now to form part of the application, and I have serious difficulty with that.
To clarify, I misspoke or was misunderstood. I don't want these proceedings, but because it is a matter which can be looked upon by application, I'm pleading with you to respect proper parliamentary procedure.
No, I do.
And ensure that the recording of what has been moved, adopted, rejected here,
yes,
it's correct.
That's fine.
So that we don't create an additional level of uncertainty. I understood the Honorable Smart having made a formal proposal from which you received notice yesterday, and the Honorable Jeffrey received notice yesterday, and the Honorable Jeffrey, having exercised his right to reject that proposal, which has been tabled here formally. So that's all I'm asking. So let's make sure that it is clear.
Yeah. Just before you come in, Mr. Jeffrey, you see, Mr. Ambrosini, there are one or two things you need to just be mindful of. Yes, you yourself said to this committee that you've been asked, or you will probably become amicus curiae. Not so. Yes, you did. Now, that's well and good. It's your right to do so. So that's a point to take into consideration.
you gave it to Mr. Jeffrey, the bill. Well, that's what you say. Should the procedure not have been for you to give the bill to Mr. Romano? No. That's the, you see, you're wanting us to follow proper procedure.
You're putting words in my mouth which I did not say. I did not say that the bill was tabled before today. The proposal has been tabled by the Honorable.
Stop, please. Stop.
Only that you personally just received notice and the Honorable.
Stop. Stop. You said the bill was given to Mr. Jeffrey. Mr. Jeffrey is not Mr. Romano. Right. Now, you are insisting now, at this stage, you're saying we have to follow proper procedure. Now, we need to be consistent then. If you're demanding we follow proper procedure, then I will say to you, you should have given that bill to Mr. Romano. Let me hear you first, Mr. Jeffrey.
Yeah, I think just from a procedural point, I mean, Ms. Smuts was correct in terms of procedure. Mr. Ambrosini or Dr. Ambrosini is not. Could well have received the email, but if I have received it, I haven't had a chance to look at it. I was busy with other issues. But it is correct. Any document should go to the committee secretary. But I think the issue is basically a committee cannot proceed with a bill unless it has permission from the House. What Ms. Smuts was asking for was that we put it to the House that we want to proceed with the bill.
That's right.
And the committee is saying no. The bill that is in circulation, or I understand is in circulation, can then be tabled or whatever, sent to the Speaker as a private member's bill. But the proposal from Ms. Smuts for a bill, it's only a proposal, not a bill, is what was not supported.
All right. Okay. Do we need to formally vote, Ms. Smuts? Honourable members, you think we should? All right. Mr. Romano suggests that we do that. Last.
I think the issue is Ms. Smuts has made a proposal. We're voting on that proposal.
All right. No, we have. All right. Those in favour of the proposal from the Honourable Dean Smuts, please raise your hands. And those opposed, please raise your hands. Do we need to put Mr. Jeffries?
No.
It dies. All right. Okay. Thank you. All right. That means our meeting is complete and adjourned. Thank you very much, all of you.
Other committees, same as